If I could carry on this, with what we began last week. Monday night is supposed to be mysticism night. So we're trying to look at the root of things, which are very deep. So it requires, as we've said before, that you use that faculty of translation. That filter that abstracts everything has to be used the whole time. If we try and deal with this subject with what the words literally say, then we haven't begun. You have to abstract it into that area where there aren't any words. Just to point out, as usual, that there are much more important aspects of Judaism or spiritual living than the depth of understanding of the mystical. It's much more important than this. This is more entertaining. The mind, the neshama, it says, is drawn more after the mystical depth than after the hard work of actually doing things in the world. So when we study these subjects, the person always has to know that if you're not acting these things out in the world, then it's a joke in the spiritual world. So if a person is involved in thinking deeply in a spiritual subject, is not activating the organs that are the expression of those spiritual organs, then it's worse than not being involved at all. But the subject that we're trying to look at is something that's beyond or above or before practical expression. If we think about it deeply, we'll be able to find some message to take home also in practice. But the essential element that we want to look at is beyond and before, deeper than the practical side. So what we tried to develop, what we tried to work out last week, was the following idea. That the essential level of being human, the spiritual, the difference between being human and not being human, the difference between having a spiritual depth, some level, some connection with transcendence, and purely being in the physical, the root of that lies in a part of the mind that can't have any words. We tried to explain this and bring some examples and proofs, which we're not going to do again. But the principle again is that as soon as you can express something in the physical, then it disappears from the spiritual. Now that's the unfortunate, that's the sad aspect. Of course it has its beauty, which is that we can get something done here, but that's another discussion. The sad side of this is that being involved in the practical world, as soon as you can express something in practice with the body or especially with the mouth, then it dies from the spiritual world. For example, the way we tried to look at it last week, it will be essential to understand it because we want to take it further, is that the Midrash says, Chazal says, that when a child is born, before he's born he understands the whole of the spiritual system. That means he's taught the whole Torah, which means that he understands the function of the whole world, that means the cosmic reality, and he understands exactly his part that he has to play, and every single detail. And as he's born, it says that the same agent, the malach, we said, the malach that teaches him how to understand all the spiritual wisdom, it says that malach smites him on the mouth, gives him a blow on the mouth, and that blow makes him forget everything he learned as he's being born. So the subtle deal that we tried to bring out last week was the fact that the same agency that teaches him spiritual wisdom is the agency that makes him forget it. Of course, as we pointed out, he doesn't really forget the spiritual wisdom, just it's driven into the subconscious. The person is born with a whole spiritual system intact. But it's driven deep into the subconscious, you have to bring it out. But the angel that teaches him the whole spiritual system, that mystical force, is the same force that makes him forget. And the Chazal say that that force is speech. That means when he learns to speak, when he is born into the physical world, that he can express himself, he then can no longer have a connection with the mystical. Explicitly, he has to search for it, and he has to grope for it, and he can only use a system of analogy in order to get there. So again, speech is a very, very dangerous thing. That's the main point we tried to work out last week. If you say something, if you can share with somebody else everything that's in your mind, then there's nothing else in your mind. And if you can express in finite, limited words, which are very, very, very fragmented, fractured things are words and pictures. Right? Because they entirely live in the finite. And if a person can reduce all his nobility and all his depth and all his spiritual aspiration and understanding into words, then his ultimate depth is only in the finite. And the essential aspect of being human is to be able to draw power from a place that's deeper than words. Right? Only you can express the bottom edge of those ideas. Just the place where they begin to concretize into the finite, then you can put that into words. But to grasp and understand the abstraction itself, by definition, can never be done with words. Which means that to really be human, to be working on yourself, to be trying to rise in the spiritual level, a person always has to have more depth. That's an obligation. To always have more depth behind what you can say. A person has to understand, of course, that when you relate to people, the sadness in this area is that you can't share the most meaningful things. You can never share the most meaningful things because you can't say them. The happiness, of course, in this is that you should choose to relate to people who understand already. But if you have your own depth of sensitivity and you relate to someone who already has his own sensitivity, so then you don't have to say anything. Like we said last week, I think it was a Brisker Rob who sat with Rav Huttner for half an hour and all they said was good yontif. But one of the great men of Yerushalayim said there was real communication. The half an hour that they spent together, two minds met. Whereas we spend half an hour together and we have plenty to say, we don't say anything at all, neither understood the other from the beginning. Right? You didn't understand what you meant, you didn't mean anything, and we pervert and prostitute the power of communication in a way that we'll try and look at a bit more fully this evening. So again, the principle is this, that you have to struggle for the words here, because this is exactly the area where there aren't any words. The only way to do it is to give examples to try to generate that power, that expression, to understand something itself without using any words. Amazing depth of this is the fact that the whole of Torah is only a mashal. The whole of spiritual teaching is only an analogy. Because spiritual teaching can never be explicit, because it's teaching about that area that's hidden from words, that area that's at the root of abstraction before you get a concrete reality, before a thing is bounded by the finite. So therefore, you want to teach about something that by definition can't be put into finite terms. So the only way you can do it is to give finite terms, which is an analogy for the infinite. As a mind, you can express the finite, the mind, the learning, the Talmud can understand from his Rebbe a finite idea. And then what happens is, of course, he mustn't stick at the mashal. He has to be able to. That's why the greatest depth of mashal in the Torah, amazing thing, is King Shlomo, King Solomon. Not Mishle. Mishle is Proverbs. But it doesn't mean Proverbs, the meaningless word in English. But Mishle means mashalim. Mashal, Mishle. A mashal means an analogy. It means a fable, something that you tell in physical words, but the whole point is to get to understand something that's deeper than the physical. And that's why Chazal say an amazing thing, that the word Shlomo, if you look at Solomon's name, Shlomo, you reverse it spells Hamashal. Right? The one who is analogy. Now that name, Shlomo, not accident that the word also means completeness, Shalem, right? And Moshel, if you rearrange the letters, it means complete rulership and control. But that's not in our subject. But you see that in the depth of the name of King Saul, Shlomo, is the one who was able to make, the way Chazal put it, they say, that along came a man. This is Chazal, says like this. The Torah was without ears. This is what Chazal says. The Torah was without ears. Was nine. But in the language of Chazal, ears means handle. Something to hold on to. So the Torah was and it had no ears. You couldn't hold on to it. Ashebo, until came along that man, King Shlomo, the kasha chevel, the chevel, the nimah, the nimah. He tied a rope to a rope and a strand to a strand. And he, Chazal means this, that there was a well so deep that no one could drink its waters. There was a well so deep you couldn't draw out the water. So along came a man and he tied a rope to a rope and a strand to a strand. He had a rope long enough to lower his bucket and he drew up the water. That chevel, that rope, that thing that he used to be able to get deep enough is a mashal. A mashal. An analogy. A mashal is taking something that you could use, nothing in itself, meaningless in itself, but it connects you with the reality. So when we want to understand the spiritual world, there's no way to understand it directly. Right? Unless you understand it already, then you don't have to talk. But if the Rebbe wants to teach something to the Talmud doesn't understand, he can't say it in words, because he's just made it finite. That's exactly the opposite of what he wants to communicate. So what he does, use a mashal, speaks about something that the Talmud in his own depth understands goes deeper than what can be expressed in words. And that's of course why it says that when teaching the mystical system, it says that the Rebbe is only allowed to tell his Talmud Reshei Prophet. He's only allowed to tell him the chapter heading. So it's just the general category. And then the details the Talmud, the student has to fill in by himself. So most people, again, this is also only a mashal. So most people get it wrong and they think it means it's some kind of spiritual game. You know, like some kind of Eastern game. That the Rebbe has to sort of put it in sort of hidden terms and the student has to figure it. It's not like that at all. The Rebbe is trying to teach a Talmud, but you can't say the details. There aren't words to explain. The Rebbe can only just nudge the Talmid along the road in general, and then the Talmid himself has to put in the details. Not because the Rebbe is hiding it from him. It's because there is no way to convey the material. Okay, that idea is what we're striving for. That means to be special, to be human, to be greater than bound to the physical, is to have a depth that you yourself aren't able to express. Huh? That a person himself can't express that idea. That means to understand the root of something, that something's true because it's true, and to know it with certainty. This faculty, in the mystical writings, is called the Da. Da. Now, we're not going to go into it in detail, but Das means knowledge. But it means real knowledge. It means inner knowledge. It means the place where the knowledge bonds with the personality, as opposed to the kind of knowledge that a computer has. A computer can also work out things. That's called the external, that's called Bina, that other names, it's an external kind of wisdom. A person can do that just the same as a computer. That doesn't make a person human. The difference between a person and a computer is that the knowledge that a person can figure out with the external mind bonds with the personality. That means not only can you figure it out, but you also know that it's true. That knowing that a thing's true can't be expressed in words. An example would be as follows. First of all, the person has to understand that the same word das also means marriage. It's the same word for marriage. This kind of knowledge means marriage. Because the concept of marriage, the intimate side of marriage, is where two become one. It's where something external to the self bonds into oneness with the self. That's what happens with external knowledge in the mind. The computer's external knowledge that the intellectual faculty can generate then has to bond with the personality. If you want an experience of this, an experience would be as follows. A simple example would be, and everybody's had an opportunity to feel this, so we could use this example. If a person works on something with the external mind, let's say, for example, you study a problem in mathematics or tomorrow, let's say, and you work on it for hours, and you get to a level where you understand, where you have the material, you have all the delineation of the problem, you have all the terms, and you run through it and you have the answer, right? And it's written in front of you. Complex mathematics, let's say. And you work on it until you know it so well that you can express it forwards, backwards, sideways. You have it memorized, and but you don't understand what it means. You ever had that experience? You've worked on something so much that you can repeat it, right? And you can even understand that each segment of the problem is logical, but you don't have a grasp of what it means. Huh? What happens? You go to sleep. You wake up the next morning, understand. Huh? Now that understanding, it wasn't due to new input. While you were sleeping, no one explained it to you. Now, you didn't have new inputs that you didn't have the day before. But when you retreat into the private area, the Gaon says that sleep is a time. What happens during sleep is a form of meditation. The external mind is switched off. But the raw mind, the inner mind, the mind that doesn't need to function with mathematical finite realities, that mind could reach further. The Gaon says your hand could reach further. That's what he means. So during sleep, a person could bond, right? And of course that's why the night time is a time of intimacy, and that's a special thing in marriage, but it's not the place to go into that. Especially after midnight, that's another issue. So that's the area we're trying to look at. Now, since that area is exactly the opposite of the explicit area, so the one damages the other. The one cannot exist where the other one exists. As soon as you can express a thing clearly, right, as soon as you can express something in the world, so you draw power and you weaken the area where there aren't any words. Unfortunately, the only example where a person can really feel this in his flesh, unless it's already been there, is something that's impossible to discuss with a mixed men and women together. But perhaps in a hint, we can talk about it as follows, and that is that the two areas that correspond in the human, right, is called Brit. What's called the Brit? The covenant, circumcision. What's called the Brit Aloshim, the tongue, and what's called the Brit Milah. That there are two organs in the body that do exactly the same function, except in the head, which is the higher system, so that bris does speech. And the bris, what's in the lower system, the body, it also creates. It also puts creative force into the world. Only thing, it creates physicality. Right? The human beings are formed from that. Whereas in the level of the mind, what the head represents, so what you create is speech. The way that Gemara puts it is that what's formed with the bris of the tongue is student, Talmidim. You create, you give birth to a student that way. What it means is you give birth to something in his mind. When you use the lower system, you give birth to his body. That's why the dinim of a Rebbe in Torah and the dinim of a person's father are very similar. A person has very similar obligations to his father as he does to his Rebbe. In some cases, his obligations to his Rebbe come first before his obligations to his father.
Why?
Because the Gemara says that the father brings you into this world, but the Rebbe brings you into the next world. Exactly the same thing. The father brings him into the lower world. That means creates his physicality and the receptacle for the Ruchniyus, the spirit. But the Rebbe brings him into the next world. That means the higher level. As I've mentioned before, a person should know that a father who pays for his child to learn Torah gets both benefits. If a father pays for his son to learn, so then all he's doing is employing a Rebbe as his agent. So then he gets the precedence, and he gets the halacha of being his father and also being his Rebbe. Well, the Rebbe who's actually teaching is just an agent of the father. So if you didn't turn out to be a great Rosh Hashiva, let's say, and you want your son to learn, and you'd like him to save your life before his Rebbe's, which, by the way, there are some dinim that saving your Rebbe's life comes before saving your father's life. So if you pay for your son to learn Torah, so if you're in a tight spot one day, of course, you shouldn't forget to teach him this halacha. That's what it is. Alright, so now. So what have we learned? We've learned that the higher system, right, always works in the more abstract. And the lower system, of course, the head itself is represented in a higher system also, which is called the mind. That's what keeps going. Within the body, in the physical, you have two systems. That's from the neck down. Those 7 points in the body that we discussed many times before, especially during the honor last year, those 7 points make up the physical body. From the neck up, the next seven, right, two ears, two eyes, two nostrils and the mouth, those 7 points are corresponding to the 7 points in the body, but they work in abstraction because the head is capable of things much less physical than the body is. The degree to which the organs in the head can stretch and have power in the physical is much more limited than the organs in the body, but in abstraction and spiritual power, much greater. And the head physically has 7 levels above that which are inside the head. And of course those have 7 and so forth and so on. But we have the analogy of body and head to be able to understand the two-layer system. So the level in the mind, so now, it comes out from this, that all sevenfold systems have a point that's called bris. Right? That's a point that's called the foundation of the system. We're not going to go into too much detail, but that's called the bris. The bris in the head is called the tongue, bris aloshin, and the bris in the body, that's called the bris mila. And if you think about it, you'll see the exact parallels. They're both creative, they're both points of connection. Speech is a point where we've mentioned this before, but again, it's difficult to speak about in detail, but just in a hint. Why is it that the mouth's functions are all connection? Now, the mouth, it's not that the Kodesh Baruch Hu couldn't figure out another organ. He could have given you something to eat with and another organ to speak with, but he didn't do that. That's one and the same organ. The organ of speech is making the connection. That's giving life in terms of the connection, like we try to explain. And speaking and eating is also making a connection, as we explained once before, that the Rambam says that eating is maintaining connection between body and the neshama. Kissing also, which we can't go into detail again. Understand that kissing is an act of love. When somebody shows affection for someone, right? Not necessarily in a sensual way. Torah times, men used to kiss each other. There's a lover and Yaakov. Or a parent for a child, it's a natural method of expressing connection between two people, right? If you think about it, it's a very strange way of establishing a connection, as we pointed out before. There's no reason why it should have been that. Why did you have to... You could have shown affection, right, in a very deep way by grinding elbows together. It could have been anything, right? Why is it that something that you would... If you think about it, it's a very strange activity, if you think about it. Unhealthy. And yet, that's a universal human expression of connection is also done with the same organ. You have to think about these things deeply. We can't spell it out too much. But once you've established this connection, we can see one thing. And here we have to be very... We can't spell it out again, but wastage of power from these two areas causes a spiritual weakness. That's the figure of that. But wastage of creative energy from these two levels. It's very difficult, especially with Tzadik Kodesh, who knows where these things are going to go to. The wastage of power from these two areas is a terrible, terrible sin. Okay, in Jewish terms, wastage of creative life force in a man, this is a man's problem. This lower area is a man's problem. According to most unfortunate women are not able to do this. Women can't sink to this. But a man can sink to the level where he spews out his creative energy in such a way that he takes away life force from himself. There's many dinim of the death forces that invest a man's body, right, when he has an experience of his own life force leaving his body. Again, that's a speaking in privacy. Maybe when we speak of the men alone, we can talk in more detail. But it's the same idea. If you translate that, right, there are many prohibitions in halacha that men are not allowed to do, okay, that are a wastage of this creative energy. the depth of it in mystical terms is because it's the innermost essence of a person's life force. It's that life force where he recreates himself. It's where he distills down his whole being up into a tremendously potent force. And when that is wasted, when that is used for no creative purpose, for no correct purpose, then it drains away his life energy. But there's not some medieval sort of superstition. That's the spiritual deficit. That feeling, and a person can understand that very well if you're sensitive as well. It's got to do with why men go to mikveh at certain times and so forth. There's a lot to understand about it. But if you translate that into the higher system in the head, it means that when a person speaks words that have no effect, when a person speaks words, puts out words into the world, that have no creative result in the world, it's dead spiritually. That's the subject that I want to look at a bit more deeply. The power of being able to speak. We need one more introduction here, which we have tried to explain before, but let's refer to it briefly again. When we talk about speech, we don't only mean with the mouth. We mean any expression of the human. Right? Any expression, anything you do with any part of the body, any way you manifest or express yourself in the world, that's also called speaking in mystical terms. Now, the root davar in Hebrew, the root dover, medaber in Hebrew, the spiritual, the root of that word doesn't mean speaking. It's only one of its manifestations. The root means to have an effect, to do something that's an action or an effect in the world. And there are many proofs of it. It says, Dabar Echad Lador, that there's one ruler of a generation. There's a man who always has the majority, the major effect on a generation. That's the same root. Vayadber Amim Tachteinu, it says in Tehillim, that Hashem will control nations under you. That means there'll be people put under your control, that you'll be the one holding the reins. So you see, the word means having an effect in the world. Speech is only one application of having an effect. It means expressing your inner essence in one particular way. And speech is the essence of where we learn this idea, because it's the connection between the spirit, between the spiritual and the physical, as we tried to say before. Taking a spiritual concept that's abstract in the mind and putting it into sound waves. So it's the organ that makes the connection between the two worlds. But really, when you do something with your hands, you're speaking every bit as much. If you take some 2 cents out of your pocket and give it to somebody who needs it, so you've spoken tremendously over there, you've taken a spiritual essence and you've translated it into physicality in the world. The only thing is that the organ of speech does it directly. And here the person has to extrapolate. He has to understand from the fact that you treated him generously what was your motivation. Whereas when he hears it in your words, he hears it directly. But speech really means the intermediate level between the abstract and doing in the world. And that's why it's a deep, deep secret also that a person is often confused by. The mystics always say that anything human consists of machshava, dibur, and maaseh. Always a threefold level. Thought, speech, and action. Not always. Thought, speech, and action. So everybody, most people get very confused. Because when you think about it, human activity doesn't have to have all three. You can think about something and do it without speaking. You don't have to say the thing. Then the misconception is that you think about the thing, then you say you're going to do it, and then you do it. But that's not true at all. There's many things you think about and do without saying. But it doesn't mean it. Again, what it means is that speech is always the level that connects the spiritual together with the physical. So you don't have to say the words. When you think something and then do it, so you're putting the two together. That transition phase, which the mystics call the neck, that phase is called speech. That's what it's called. Now. This thing called speech. This thing of translating the spiritual into the actual. Now, again, we're going to proceed from here only with that thought of abstraction on. Otherwise, we're going to hear fairy stories. Fairy stories, by the way, originated by a world that took the spiritual head and cut it off the animals. So we're left with things that are meaningless. Right? That's exactly what's called Dvarim B'Tehillim. If you know the origin, if you look at fairy stories that the non-Jewish world has, you'll see they've got tremendous depth behind them. They all connected to Chazal. They come from Kabbalistic sources. The forest means something, and the princess means something, and the king means something. They all mean something. The great Hasidic masters have used these stories to bring out depth. But unfortunately, we live in a world where people don't know that, so they see the world and they think that's what it is. They don't know there's a head connected to the body. That's what we have to try and understand. Now, this level called speech, this translation level, has got one specific problem area that we want to try and look at more. And that is what's called Dvarim B'Tehillim. Dvarim B'Tehillim is the sin. That's the sin of doing things that are meaningless. Literally, it means speaking nonsense. Dvarim B'Tehillim means speaking nonsense. Right? That's a tremendous crime in Jewish terms. That's a spiritual death in Jewish terms. And people sit around and talk nonsense, that they're dying spiritually. Worse than if they just weren't doing anything. It's akin and it's analogous to taking the spiritual force that we spoke about before that a man can do and wasting it in the world with no effect in the wrong place. That it's like that, but on a more refined level. Of course, you should understand from this, it doesn't only mean speaking nonsense, it means doing nonsense also. That what the most, let's understand where this goes to. Most of this generation is primarily involved in it. When people aren't at work, which is a healthy activity, the Chazal says, and the sages who say that every time they declare public holiday, it's death to a large section of the population. People get killed on public holiday. It's a very unhealthy thing for the world. What the healthy activity is working. Then third, people are working, they're doing something, engaged in something useful, and they're producing something useful. And when people aren't working, this generation, if you look around, you'll see, spends its time enjoying the time. Either speaking nonsense, or doing nonsense. Right? Either putting out garbage or taking in garbage, one or the other. That's this generation. It has a tremendous desire, right, to be involved. Now, where does this come from? Right? Why? What's the root of this thing? Let's first, before we understand the root of it, of course the practical message we want to get out of this is how to control it. Okay? Although we're not speaking about the practical halachas over here. We want to take on something practical from these spiritual ideas. But let's look at the idea in depth. First of all, you see that the punishment for Dvarim Batalim is an amazing thing. What are the punishments in the next world for doing things that you're not allowed to do? So we have certain punishments for certain things. The worst that a person could undergo, a very, very bad experience in the next world, tremendously painful. You know, we can't even mention the pictures that are given as descriptions because they're so powerful that people definitely don't make the connection with the abstraction. But when the tortures of the next world are described in graphic terms, because that's the only way you can describe them in pictures, so then people always translate it into some medieval sort of superstitious Christological misconception. But it doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that. It means that every detail is meant literally. There's no question about it. It's meant 100% literally, but it's not meant physically. But the tremendous concept of suffering for having done things a person shouldn't have done. But when it comes to Dvarim Batalim, when it comes to what people spent their lives doing nothing meaningful, not doing any sin, not harming anybody, but not doing any damage in the world, not punch anyone in the nose or cause anybody's life to end short, or nothing like that. Cause anybody suffering. Just speaking nonsense. I'm not talking about speaking what's forbidden to speak. That's Lashon Hara, Rechilat, Mesi Shemra, that's how things are terrible punishment. I'm not talking about that. Just talking about 2 or 3 hours that you sat over the dinner table, went out for dinner, and you spent the evening talking nonsense. The punishment for that in the next world, it says, is a special kind of Gehenna. That person has to understand this clearly. There's a special Gehenna. That means there's a special dimension of suffering that exists in the next world in which a person has to suffer the pain of those times, those parts of his life that he spends doing things that's called Dvarim Batalim. Let's understand it more deeply. What is this Gehenna? Let us approach it that way. What is this special Gehenna? What is the special torment that a person who wastes time, you know, wastes time? What is that special Gehenna? So it's called Kapha Kela. That's what it's called. What does it mean? That's a mystical idea, but it means that it means the pad of the slingshot, the part of the slingshot where the a catapult is. You have this what? Not the sling, the part that holds whatever it is, the place where you put the thing in. Right? That thing that holds it. I know Hebrew's got a word that's called kapakela. That's what it's called. That's what it's called. That's a special thing. What is that? Now the mystics explain something like this. For all other problems that a person did in the world, you took something and you generated something wrong. You took life force, you took some part of your energy, something that you could have done in the world, and you created something negative, right? You put it in, instead of, let's say speech, instead of saying something that could have helped somebody, right? You instead of sitting, you see a person's got a need. Somebody's lonely, they're suffering, they've got a problem. You could have said a few words that would have helped that person. Right? You could have booked something positive. Instead, you said Lashon Hara, you hurt them. You spoke about somebody negative, what you're not supposed to do. You took life force and you fractured something in the spiritual world. You damaged your Neshama, you damaged that person's Neshama, you damaged the cosmic reality. So the punishment in the next world is to suffer damage. The punishment in the next world is to suffer the consequences, to experience the consequences of what you broke. It's like they say, the pain of a broken limb. Because you broke that limb. So in the next world, you experience the pain of having broken it. The only thing is, in this world, you get an extension. So you don't feel it immediately. When they do some damage in this world, so you damage this part or that part of the neshama. Now, it's like you fell and broke an arm. So in the next world, what happens is, the shields, the illusion is taken away.
So there you live with a spiritual body, and every organ that you broke, every organ that you damaged, that you hacked out, that you caused to bleed, it's bleeding there. Except the pain is not there. That's the idea. But That's this thing. That's called kapatella. That's a special thing. The experience is the next word. Again, we have to, this is not, we have to be accepted and accepted and established to understand these, not with the usual part of the mind, not just the television part of the mind.
But that's a level, that's an experience like this. As best as we can put it into words, it's the experience of being slung from one place to another, of being fired from one place to another, but as the neshama is about to reach a position of rest, it's flung back again. That means the experience of the neshama is being projected in what should be development, but before it reaches development, it's projected again. It will never come to rest. That means it's the agony of being able to move towards something, but to never get there, and then you're moving again. Why is such a strange punishment, a mitzvah reshuna, such a strange punishment, torment, cooked up for having wasted time? Now, the idea is as follows. The concept that we have of the next world, it's not some place that a person goes that they torture a person. That we don't have such a concept. That they give you something to enjoy or they give you something that's fine for. The Jewish concept of the next world is you. Yes? The Jewish concept of the world to come. It's the world that's always becoming. But that's you. You don't go someplace where you experience things external to yourself. That's the depth of the Gemara, that the Gemara says that in the next world, every person is alone. Now it says, every person in the next world has a cut out existence of his own with no contact with anybody else. Except husband and wife, it says, form a unit up there. Husband and wife go up as a unit. So that's good news for some. That's what it says. But apart from that, but that's not called connection with somebody else. That's called, because the unit of marriage, which we have to talk about next week, which is a week after, is the concept of forming a unity. But apart from that, it doesn't really mean that the neshama is alone. What it means is that the neshama experiences itself. What the next world is an experience of the raw essence of what you became. And that's the happiness of the next world, that's the sadness. The happiness of the next world is a person translated all his potential into action. He spent 120 years translating every ounce of potential energy that he had into something actual. Huh? Every moment of his life that he could have used for something, he used for that thing. Every moment that he used for that thing built the neshama in that area. It built that 1/613th part of his neshama. So that organ is glowing brightly. That's what the mystics say. That gets switched on. So the next world, it's glowing, it's alive, it's there. The sadness of the next world is that a person damaged that organ, so the light isn't on there. And he's suffering the agony of having seen what he could have done with it and having realized that he didn't do it and not being able to do it now. That's the pain of the next world. The pain of the next world is seeing what you should have done, what you could have done, how easily you could have done it, and the fact that you didn't. And that's why, as I was saying, that the person, what a person has to overcome in this world, what's called the energy that a person has to exert to overcome the obstacle called the yetzer in this world, that tzaddikim in the next world, when they are shown what they overcame, as I'll say, they see an enormous mountain. A tzaddik gets to the next world, right? He used every minute correctly, did what he's supposed to do. They show him an enormous mountain, which is what he overcame. A rosha who gets to the next world, who never coped, but a person who never did what he's supposed to do, and he experiences failure, they show him how powerful was his yetzer hara as thin as one hair. That's what it says. The tzaddik sees that there was an incredible mountain that he overcame, but also sees that it was one hair breadth thick that he should have been able to get through and he didn't do it. Think about that deeply also. But the experience, again, is an experience of the reward. The reward isn't that they hand out something nice. The reward means that a person is essentially, intrinsically experiences who he is. That's the concept of the next world. And of course, people who are sensitive can feel it now. You don't have to wait till there. Somebody who's sensitive to what he is, who doesn't spend his days trying to build muscle only or something physical only. A person who's sensitive to his own existence, he knows he can achieve something or not. Of course, modesty sometimes, a person who's genuinely got another, sometimes that. Chaim Sonnenfeld, he used to say, he was the greatest tzaddik of his generation, he was the leader of the Yishuv in Yishalayim, he was the Rebbe of Yishalayim in the turn of the century. Well worth reading, there's an English book about him called The Guardian of Jerusalem, it's the most amazing and fascinating book. But he used to say, thank God for his wife, Baruch Hashem that he married her. Because he used to say that, I myself for sure don't deserve Gan Eden. To go to the next world I don't deserve for sure. But she's such a tzaddik, they're going to let her in, and they'd never upset her by leaving me out. For sure. But he was just had another, yeah. But he made me sure he. That's our concept of the next world. Okay, now. If that's true, it means that every agony and every ecstasy in the next world is an exact reflection of what you did. Because that's what it is. It's not given to you because of that. It is that. There's so many examples of it. It says, for example, when you embarrass someone. If a person says something, you embarrass somebody, you said something that caused pain. The experience you have in the next world is facing that person over and over and over and over ad infinitum, feeling the pain of what you said. It isn't pain. You're right. Laugh now. That's what it says. So, now, if that's true, it means that every punishment, so-called punishment in the next world, is the not the consequence, it is the essence of what you did here. Which means it has to be matched exactly to what the crime was. Right? That's called midah keneged midah. The thing there is matched exactly to what you did here. But not only is it matched exactly, it is what you did. Right? That is what it is. Yeah? Wasting time, what's called boring batalis, what's called speaking power, taking something that was power, and blasting it out into a place where it just dissolves into nothingness. So what you did was you took power, and before it got where it should have gotten, you just let it disappear. Did it? Yes? You took something that could have been the most creative energy that a person can master, powerful enough to create a human being, not if we're talking about the lower system, or in the higher system, powerful enough to create even higher things than that. And a person took that energy of infinite value, and he blasted it out into a place where it just disappeared. So the sensation that a person has in the next world is the sensation of being blasted himself to some place, and before he gets there, being moved on again. Right? Of course, as we said before on Sunday night, that's what the Rambam says. The Mekubalim explained that, of course, it's this suffering that works a correction. But ultimately, it is this suffering itself. There's no point in suffering in the next world just for the sake of suffering. Hashem isn't vindictive. He doesn't put people through that suffering just for the sake of making them suffer. Right? For infinity. That's not the concept. The concept is that a person suffers and it's the agony that regrows that part of the neshama. When a person works and works and works and works over and over again on the pain of not having done what he should have done, so that regrows, right? Except that regrows it the painful way. A person could have done it the pleasant way in this world, but if you leave it for the next world, it's the painful way, but it is regrown in the end. That means everybody gets to perfection in the end. The only thing is it could take a long time, whatever time means in that world, and it's painful whereas it could have been pleasant here. But everybody... So it doesn't really mean, and it's not an infinity of suffering. It has a measure of time, whatever time means in that world, but finally, everything is regrown that should have been regrown, which means that every person is going to get to perfection in the end. The only question is which route. Free will can only affect which route you take to get there. As the Mephoshim say, you either do it through simcha or they grind it into your back. But they either, with hobnail boots, they grind it into you. That means the kvod shamayim that has to come out of you, they either get it out through simcha in this world or through screens. But the kvod shamayim that has to come out of the person, they get out of you. That's the final. Okay, so again, what have we learned? We've seen that the concept... Now, you look at this generation, and it means us. It doesn't mean them out there. It means us. You'll see that the experience of this generation is wasting time. That's what it is. You see that people who are sensitive to Torah, people who have been brought up in Torah, people especially the Balei Teshuva, are the most sensitive to it, especially people who got families, or people who don't understand what they're doing. The worst, of course, is when you're involved in a society like that and they speak Lashon Hara. Because that's really... So you're not allowed to hear that. So there... And of course, you look crazy. You start changing the subject. You start developing a sort of pain in the stomach. You've got to run out of the room. People think you've gone crazy. But you're trying to explain to people that this and this and this you're not allowed to say. You're not allowed to hear. So they think you're crazy. You have to do it. But the agony of Dvarim Batavi... I remember once an evening I had to spend with some people. I remember I was sitting with my brother-in-law. And we had to entertain some people, and with people we couldn't speak to. We couldn't speak about Torah, we couldn't speak... But we had to entertain them, because connections of the family, so, and we spent 2 or 3 hours at the table speaking nonsense. And the pain is, again, that's an experience that we were sensitive to, but we do it ourselves. And we enjoy it. We enjoy it. One of the most intense pleasures is to get together for a... I don't know where you do it, maybe you go to the shopping mall with your friends in the middle of the morning and you sit over a cup of tea, and the pleasure of the relationship is just to talk nonsense, nothing significant, just to spend time speaking of. We make a social activity out of it also. We go out for dinner. People go out for dinner. They don't have a business discussion around the dinner table, or discuss, you know, the future of the world or what you can do about it. People go out for dinner, and if you think about it, there are tremendous problems. First of all, you socialize men and women, right? You with his wife, and him with your wife, which the Mephoshim says, also, it's forbidden, you're not allowed to do that. Right? I'm not, even if you don't kiss them when you arrive. That's forbidden, first of all. And second of all, not only that, but what you say, the center of activity is dinner. That means you take a physical activity, you're feeding the body, and you make a whole thing out of it. You get dressed up and you play music. And like a Vigna minister says, it's not much different from using the bathroom. That's also taking care of the body. You don't get dressed up for that and play music over it. You don't go out in a crowd. So the first message is taking care of that function, right, which is feeding the body, also not such a good idea for social activity. There is a depth to it. There is a special depth to eating with other people. There is a depth, as you correctly, it has very powerful spiritual force, which is why we make a mezuzah. There's a fire to it. It has tremendous kedusha, and that's where the world feels a connection over food. That's why the world feels that there's a connection when you eat other food. That's why when three people eat together, you bench differently. And when 10 people eat together, you bench with Hashem's name. Right? And it's overeating that you do that. Right? You don't daven any differently when you have people together. Right? You don't daven differently. It's kedusha, but when you sit together over a meal, that special activity, when you have a number of people, you put Hashem's name in. And it's got to do with the fact that the mouth is an organ of connection, like we spoke before. Eating is a connection, and it's also a connection between people. That's not tonight's subject. But talking nonsense, right, that accompanies it. Now, the way we could look at this thing is as follows. One more idea. Let's try and work it out. There's a big problem, a big spiritual problem in this area. Let's try and ask this question. I heard this question asked by a very, very great man in Shalai, my Rebbe. He asked this question and try and understand the answer. The question is as follows. The question is, why do we enjoy wasting time? Why do we enjoy speaking nonsense? Let's understand the problem. The problem is this. I'll put it to you this way. There's a Chazal that says the following thing. Chazal say this, that when a person gets to the next world, they will hold him accountable for what he did. If he has an excuse for what he did, it will be to his benefit. If he has no excuse for what he did, he has to pay the full price. What does it mean? It means this. If a person gets to the next world and they say to him, why did you do this and this and this? And the accusations against him are things that the tither was connected to, things that felt good, things that he had a drive, a passion for, so he'll have an excuse. He'll be able to turn around to the Kodesh Baruch and he'll say to him, you gave me the drive. You gave me the Yetzer. Why did I do this and this and this that's forbidden in the sensual area? You gave me the Yetzer in that area. You gave me an almost irresistible drive in that area. So I wasn't able to control it. So they'll give you a big reduction. It says you get a big discount. Right? That's a big excuse that you can use. But if they hold against you things that you did in the next world that didn't have any passion attached to them, a person did something here that had no passion, that he didn't benefit from, that didn't feel good, didn't earn any extra money through it. If he stole, he'll have an excuse. He had acquisitiveness. He wanted to add it to his family. He wanted to be rich. He had a drive, a desire. I'm not saying this excuse will take you all the way, by the way. You have a heavy price to be paid for these things.
So another big excuse. To the degree to which you could have controlled. But were he good things that the body didn't speak to him about, that had no pleasure and no benefit, that will be a tremendous punishment. What if I was talking about? They're talking about speech. Because when a person did a sin with a body, like the other kind of thing that we spoke about earlier, those kind of areas, you'll say, I had a yoker for it, I had a tremendous drive in that area. But why did you speak badly about somebody? You spoke badly about someone, and it give you any benefit? Or what, you spoke nonsense? Did it benefit you in any way? Did you relax any better than you were relaxing with us? Did it earn you any money? Did it give you any physical pleasure? It gave the person nothing. Huh? So since it gave you nothing, what excuse will you have? You can't say, I had a drive and an insatiable desire to be able to do these things. It felt so good. That's what it is. Question is this. That's it. What is this Chazal talking about? Chazal said it doesn't feel good. Person has no drive to speak nonsense because it's a completely neutral experience. It does feel good. It feels wonderful. It feels fantastic. I have people get together for hours to speak nonsense. There's a answer for it. There's a tremendous drive to spend to waste time. To waste time, to have time out. I'm not talking about a person who needs to relax to get back into work again. Or a person who takes time out from his tomorrow to clear his mind so he can concentrate. I'm not talking about that. That's kedusha. That's called exuberant zehu kiyumo. When a person takes off time from a labor in order to recharge, that's the justification we have for sleeping at night. The Jewish reason. The reason you sleep at night is because you couldn't achieve the next day without sleeping. There's no other justification for wasting a third of your life. You have many hours that you spend in unconsciousness, you never get that time again.
the evil of wasting time is the fact that it's so precious. The concept of wasting time. Now, is the whole reason for this terrible, all these terrible things he's speaking about this evening is only because it's so precious. When a person spends an hour wasting time, achieving nothing, but a dying man would give for 1 hour, give anything. But a man is about to die. What would he give for one more day? Give anything for one more day. And you spend the day doing nothing? There is one kind of holiday that's allowed. That's the experience that a person needs to take off, to clear his mind, to recharge, to commune with nature. You got to escape from the stress and get back. That's kedusha. That's like sleeping. But there's no other justification. In Jewish terms, if you sleep all morning for no other reason that you feel like sleeping, that's suicide. That morning will never come again, and you spend it unconscious. You'll never get that consciousness back. So a day that a person spends at the beach, that's to be clearly understood. A day that a person spends at the beach in Jewish terms, that's suicide. Unless, of course, Rabbi Yashin goes to the beach. Rabbi Yashin, I happen to know, my brother-in-law told me so. The poster of this generation. That once a year, he sits on the beach and he looks out at this, he looks at the sunset and everything, and then he goes out. Once a year. All right, so he doesn't sit on the beach, but he's using the time. To use the time for whatever it gives you. So that's different. But time out, you know what people call it? They call it killing time, they're right? It's this, it's suicide. People call killing time. That is to find a few things to kill time. That's what it is. That's spiritual death. That time will never come again. Person gets older, you feel this more. Now, why does it feel so good then? Why does Chazal say it doesn't feel good? And any common experience, anybody knows that it feels very good. Right? Wasting time. And if you analyze it carefully, if you're sensitive, you'll see that not only does it feel good, there are many elements, you have to be very careful, there are many elements. When a person sits around speaking nonsense, part of the pleasure is just being able to break the concentration, being able to take the mind off what you were engaged in before. That could even be an activity of kedusha. So that could be justified at some certain times. There's that. There's the fact of socializing, there's the fact of getting closer to the people that you speak to. There are many elements that give pleasure. We're not talking about those. Don't confuse those. There's a special pleasure in talking nonsense, apart from all these others. I'll give you an example. There was a certain Hasidic Rebbe in the last generation. This is what they say about him. They say that he used to go into the mikveh and used to chatter nonsense. Right? A man whose every word was controlled used to walk into the mikveh as he was getting undressed and taking a shower and using the mikveh, he talked nonsense. Why? Because the Yetzer needs an expression. You know, the way to deal with the Yetzer in Jewish terms, the way to deal with doubt and negativity is not to try and switch it off. Because what happens is it starts cooking inside. And then it bites very bad. So we never switch off the Yetzer, we're always deflecting into an area that's kosher. That's why our person has used it. Yetzer, you have to know what's kosher, what's not, how to deflect it, but that's what it is. So the Yetzer for speaking nonsense, he used to use in the mikveh, because you can't speak kedusha in the mikveh. Place the people undressed in the bathroom, you never know, think Torah. Person's not allowed to think to be very Torah in the bathroom, that's why many people, I keep the medical journals in the bathroom, I don't know what you keep, but people keep things in the bathroom. Right? The Gaon used to study mathematics, the Gaon used to have his mathematics books in the bathroom, he used to do that. It says in halakha, in the kitzur shulchan aruch, the person should think about his business in the bathroom. To stop himself from thinking, halakha, we should have a problem that we need to stop thinking about this. But there were great Rosh Yeshiva, there were great tzaddikim of the last generation, that people gave testimony when they came out of the bathroom, they were sweating, the veins standing out in their face, right, at the effort of having to control themselves from not thinking in the Gemara, only thinking in kedusha. There's a tremendous effort of self-control not to think in kedusha, halakha, we should be on a, like that. We have, reason. Of course, what happens this generation, as you walk into the bathroom, they start thinking kedusha. That's what happens. Because the Yetzer, that's exactly what happens, because the Yetzer doesn't stop you over there. When you're sitting at the Gemara, the Yetzer says, wouldn't it be nice to go for a cup of coffee? To do this, yeah, nonsense. He attracts you with nonsense, anything other than the Gemara. But you go to the bathroom, he has a mind if you think kedusha over there. So there, I remember a Baal Shiva told me, I don't want to say his voice, but people know, but I remember a Baal Shiva told me after 3 months of being through, one day I saw him crying. I said to him, what's wrong? He said to me, he's having a tremendous effort with self-control of his mind. So the whole problem is going through. He said, well, so I'm sitting with the right crowd, I'm sitting with the boss, and he only knows one pasuk in the Torah. He'd only learned enough Torah. All he knew was one pasuk, and he couldn't. That's a separate point. Now, so when a person's in the bathroom, you can't think in kedusha, you can't think in debate Torah. And according to Michael Foshin, where people undress, even in room, a place where people undress, like the bathroom, even if there's no toilet over there, but just the bathroom, even there, you're not allowed to think in debate Torah. So when he was undressing and he was in the mikveh, he can't think in kedusha, so he used to give vent. So the Yetzer, the sweet nonsense. I don't know, he spoke about the football fixtures, I don't know, the latest scores, and some stuff that doesn't make any difference to the world at all. My Rebbe said that he didn't used to do that. for another reason, and that's because the tool of speech is such, got such holiness, got such kedusha attached to it, that even when you're not allowed to speak in kedusha, but you're not allowed to speak in it, because it's taking a tool and using it for something that's good. It's taking something with tremendous potential for kedusha and using it. Even though, and therefore what he was speaking over there was, he was speaking chesed, he was asking people how they were, he was doing chesed, I read the bathroom altogether is chesed. Right? It's taking care of yourself, it's looking after you. Hillel used to say, when he used to excuse himself from the yeshiva, they used to say, where are you going? He said, he's going to take care of the small hotel where he stays. He was going to take a shower. He stays in a small hotel. He meant he's going to look after his body, he's going to do chesed. He said he's going to do chesed to the innkeeper. Right? That means he's going to wash his body. So therefore the whole concept of using the bottle as a chesed, and therefore you can do chesed over there, you can do mitzvahs over there. You break kedusha, you can't, but mitzvahs you can. So you speak to people, ask how they were, and you speak about their chickens, whatever it was, and so that's what he was doing. But the point is this, you see from this, there is at least a story, there is at least a concept that there's a yetzer for speaking on. Let's spend just a few minutes on trying to understand why we have that yetzer. Why this generation, the world that doesn't have prophecy, the world as we know it, we spoke at length many times about when prophecy ended, about the Mikdash was destroyed, how it is that after that generation the whole world is different, and why it is that in this generation, after that time, we have a yetzer for speaking nonsense that didn't exist before. We haven't got time to go into it again, but what people have to do, they have to go and think about how all pervasive this problem is. It's not just getting together as a couple of cops that you want to talk about. We actually build it, we build the nonsense. We build and we pay for it, right? We make a whole entertainment industry of the nonsense, right? We make a whole social activity. Almost every waking minute of the secular Western world's life that isn't spent in work is spent in growing battalion. Almost every, but even a large element of reading the newspapers, even. Far too much forbidden to see over there. I'm not saying you shouldn't read the newspapers. But a large part of what people listen to, take in their mind, even though it seems things of great import, right, is just, it's a fantasy in the mind. It doesn't have any practical outcome for a person. Yeah? Now, to understand this, you have to understand this. Now, this is a very, very difficult Gemara. This Gemara is speaking about a very, very concrete word, but it's speaking about ideas that are dangerous almost. If it wouldn't be written in the Gemara, I don't think we'd be able to say the word. But let's hear what it is. A very, very fascinating Gemara. The Gemara says the following thing. How the Gemara gets onto the subject is not our business right now, but there was a case like this in the Gemara. There was a time in Jewish history when there was a tremendous drive in the Neshama, in the human soul, to worship idolatry. We don't have that today. We have throw-offs, spin-offs, right? Reverberations, nuances of this in the Neshama. But we don't have a desire to bow down to a piece of wood or to worship the sun. We don't have that today. There was a time in Jewish history which coincided with a period that led up to the second destruction of the second diocese, before them, where the energy, the drive in the human neshama to connect with something that wasn't the ultimate source was so strong that it was almost irresistible. In fact, it was the strongest, one of the strongest drives and urges that the human neshama felt. It was so strong to worship, that means to be over, to relate deeply, to give your mind, to give your neshama, to give your being, right, to marry something that wasn't the source of existence, that it was almost uncontrollable. It was the strongest, almost the strongest human urge. Not almost the strongest human urge. The Rambam says it began because they started worshipping intermediaries in the power system. Instead of looking at Hashem, they looked at the sun, which was an emissary, it was an intermediary, and therefore they looked to it as a valid place of transmission of power. And eventually they ended up looking at it and said, oh no, how it happened is not our business again. But there was a tremendous drive, irresistible drive. There's a famous Gemara that says, the drive was so strong that when the drive became weaker, when it entered a phase where the drive was weaker, which is what we're going to try and study this evening, how this drive left the human neshama. When it became weaker, there was no way that people could even understand how there was that drive before. How the greatness of those generations, at that level of spiritual greatness, could have such a drive to worship a piece of stone, a piece of wood, something in nature. The Gemara says that Ravashi, one day Ravashi entered the Beis Medrash, and he said, Niftecha v'chadroi. We have stopped talking about our friend, but the word in Aramaic means like our buddy. It was a denigrating, it was a word of belittling words that used about our friend. Who was he talking about? The king Menashe. The king Menashe. And he started giving a shir about Menashe. Who was Menashe? He was a Jewish king who was guilty of idolatry. So Rav Ashi spoke disparagingly about him because, for a special reason, it says that it's a mitzvah to mock that force. Mockery is never allowed in Jewish terms. Mockery is never allowed, except for that which deserves mockery, which is a parody of reality, a mockery of reality, which is idolatry. So look at something that sets itself up as being the source of Kedusha, and actually is only to cope with other, like a monkey in front of a man. So since that's a parody, a mockery of the essence, so it's a mitzvah to mock that. But it's the only thing that's in it. So he wanted to use that, and he started speaking in mockery. He says, mitzvah the chabroi. Let's start talking about our friends in a disparaging way. So that night, Menashe came to him in a dream. Menashe appeared to him in a dream, and he said, who are you calling your friends? And he asked him a question in Halacha, a very interesting question, and Rav Ashi couldn't answer. So Menashe told him the answer. So Rav Ashi realized that he was a man of tremendous Torah depth. So he said to Menashe, if you're so great, you know so much Torah that you could teach me so much, how come you went for Avodah Zorah? So Menashe said to him the following words, had you lived in my generation, you would have picked up your cloak to enable you to run to Avodah Zorah. We at least went with dignity. We walked sedately to Avodah Zorah. Had you been in my generation, your lack of control would have been so great you would have run for Avodah Zorah, for idolatry. We won't go into why that cut, except in this dimension. But the idea is that there was a time when it was irresistible, tremendously great, and there came a point when it was easily controlled to the extent that today we don't feel it at all. How did that happen? How did the human psyche change to the point where idolatry was the most powerful force in the world, and suddenly we don't feel it anymore? And anybody who's sensitive has a lot of trouble understanding how people bow down to some element of nature. The Gemara says the following thing. There was a time when idolatry was so powerful that people could not control themselves, right? So they said the following thing. Look what's happened to us. This generation, the Sanhedrin at that time, among the Sanhedrin, the generation of Ezra, the last three prophets who were alive, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, that was their generation, the time of the second bias. They said the following thing. Look what we've been through. Look at our sufferings and our exile and our tortures and destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And despite all the suffering we've been through, the Adayim Malachet Beinah, he's still dancing among us. The Yetzer Hara, the tremendous drive to idolatry, still dances among us. So it says like this. You know why it's given to you? Hashem said, Yahav Teilan, you know why I've given it to you? Elam Ekliberi Agra. I've given it to you for reward. Why do I give you it's a tremendous Gemara, this explains a lot of things. We won't have time to go through all the elements. But why did I give you this ordeal in life? Why did I give you such an almost irresistible ordeal for the reward? The more difficult the ordeal that you overcome, the more you grow. The heavier weight you can pick up in the gym, the bigger the muscle you build. So the more the neshama has to overcome, has to struggle with and overcome, the greater the difficulty, the greater the spiritual reward. So I gave you this almost irresistible force to overcome for tremendous reward. What did the Chachamim say? This is what they said to Hashem. Let's understand this deeply. Again, said like this. We don't want it and we don't want its reward. That's what Chachamim said. The Sanhedrin said to Hashem, never mind, take it back, keep it. Never mind it and never mind its reward. We're not interested in the reward. We'll rather live on the level where we don't have the reward than take the risk. And this is the way a tzaddik lives, by the way. A tzaddik doesn't battle his yetzer. He gets into situations where his yetzer can't operate. Right? That's the path of spirituality. The path of spirituality is not a dramatic one when you confront the yetzer and try and battle it. The spiritual path is to avoid the yetzer. You don't try and get locked in a battle with him. It's too dangerous. You get into a situation like all the reporters say, you should move in next to the Mil Yeshiva if you can. That's where you should make a hard find out, because you'll be too embarrassed to walk around in your underwear. Not because you're on a spiritual level, but the Rosh Hashanah might see you. So you put yourself in a situation where, for external reasons, you can't do wrong. You don't go into a place where... So it says like this. We don't want it. We don't want it to reward. So what happened? Nafalu pitkanurikia. They have a tzavba emes. A sign came from heaven. I don't understand what this means. I don't know what a pit is. And it was on it to sit emes. It's true. You're right. You might say something about that, and then it goes like this. So they sat in a fast for 3 days and 3 nights, right? And it was given to them. the yetzer for idolatry, the power in the human soul to worship idolatry, was given into their power. So it says when they saw that they were able to control it, they called it up, and it says it came flaming out of the Kodesh Kodoshim, flaming out of the holiest place on earth, the inner sanctum of the Beit HaMikdash. That's where it lives. Where does this yetzer of idolatry live? Not in some sleazy gutter. It lives in the Kodesh Kodoshim, the inner sanctum, the holiest place of the Beit HaMikdash, on the Beit HaMikdash, where the Aron is kept. That's where it lives. So this force for the greatest evil lives in the place of the greatest Kodesh. It has to be that way. It has to be that. The same drive. The same drive. Question is just the direction. That's all. So it came flaming out of the Kodesh Kodesh, and they killed it. So they shechted it. This is the Yetzer. Then they said, how do we kill it? The whole discussion. Very interesting how they killed it. We're going to go into that now. They killed it. Killed it. And from that moment on, the world didn't have any drive to idolatry. In the Gemara, they saw that it was an Eis Ratzon. They saw that Hashem was listening to them. It was an Eis Ratzon. It was a time of desire. Hashem was giving them what they wanted. So they said, why stop? If Hashem's giving us, we've got the hotline, we've got the connection, so let's not stop. Let's take care of other problems. So it says at that moment they called up the Yetzer for Arayas. The Yetzer for sensuality. The sexual Yetzer Hara. That drive, it causes a lot of problems in the world. Most of the problems. There's places where it says that it's the driving force behind idolatry. But either does it matter. So they called it up. And it says they held it in chains. They held it. They held this thing. It's flame. It's a lion of flame, it says. So then they said to each other, but 1 second, hold it, before we kill it. If we kill this Yetzer, there won't be people for it. If we kill this Yetzer for sensuality in the world, then a man feels for the woman. So there's no one going to have children anymore. So it says they didn't know what to do, they kept it in captivity for 3 days. So 1 second. So let's daven. Let's ask. Let's body rachme. Let's daven like this. Ni body rachme apolga. Let's try and kill half of it. So Rashi says, what does it mean kill half? That a man should have a desire only for his wife, but for all other women, it should die. They're very healthy there. So the Gemara says, polga berakia lo yavi. They don't give hearts. In Shaman, they don't give hearts. You can't do that. That's the way it works in the spiritual system. A man feels that, he feels it. If he doesn't feel it, then they can't have it like that. So they didn't know what to do. So it says what they did was they blinded him. They managed to blind this Yetzer and they let him go. What does it mean? The Gemara says they blinded him. It means they made a person from that day on have a desire. A man should have a desire for a woman, a sensual desire for a woman, but not for his close relatives. From that day on, men were born in the world, right? Men lived in the world. They have a very strong desire for women, but not for their mother or sister. Which is a unique thing. Person's mother or sister might be very attractive. They might be very attractive. Very, very feminine, very attractive. They might have everything going for them that should make it. A person is not born with a natural desire. A person does not have a normal male. Does not have a normal desire for his mother or sister. That's an amazing thing. It's a long discussion with Gemara. Why is not that? It's not called hearts. The other thing is called hearts. That's not such a much question. What did you see from this tomorrow? See the following. Now this is difficult. This is the difficult part. We'll finish with this. This is the difficult part. When they wanted to mevatel the yetzer, when they wanted to undo, dissolve, destroy the drive for negativity, they wanted to destroy the drive for idolatry. For that, there are many things that happen when you kill them. That's important. Okay? That's important. When you kill the drive for idolatry, many other things die as well. When you kill that in the human neshama, where was this thing that they killed? Where was it? It wasn't in the belt, running around. It's in the human soul, in the neshama. What they were doing was surgery on the neshama. When they took this flame, but that's not what this flame means. It doesn't mean literally, physically a fire, a flame. It means it literally is a fire. Definitely it's a fiery lion, as the Gemara says. But you have to know where it is. It's here. They were doing surgery on the neshama, and that's why it was the Kodesh Kodashim. That's the neshama of the world. That's why they're operating in there. It had to be in the Mikdash. That's the blueprint, the genes of the world. They went into where the genes of the spiritual world are located, that which codes for the human neshama, and they killed those genes. So that no human would have that part of his soul, of his psyche, of his desires anymore. When you kill that part of the neshama, everything that it does dies. Not only, what happens? Immediately when they did that, there's a Gemara, prophecy ends. Prophecy dies. Why? They didn't want to kill the Ruach. I didn't want to stop prophecy in the world. That's our connection. You can't have one without half they don't do. Half from the shaman they don't do. Why? He said like this. You can't do surgery on the Rishoma and take out a target. You can't, if you take the liver out, if you operate on a person and you take out his liver, you lose all the functions of the liver. That's obvious. You can't take out one biochemical function of the liver. If you take out the organ, everything the organ does disappears. When you take out this organ of the Neshama, you can't take it out of heart. There's an organ in the Neshama, a part of the mind. When you take that part out of the spiritual structure of the human, when you take that part out, everything that it does disappears. What is that part of the Neshama? That's the organ in the Neshama that wants to transcend. That's the desire in the human Neshama. That's the desire in the human that wants to connect with the source. It wants to lift itself beyond what I am. It wants to expand beyond my borders, beyond my limitations. That's a desire that the human has. It's translated in the world as a desire to travel, new experiences, new relationships. But the essence of it spiritually is the desire to transcend and be more than what I am. The most powerful application of that drive is the Kodesh Baruch Hu, to get to the source of reality. If you could hook up to the source of power, now that would be the most tip. But that drive, like all powers in the human, can be used for good or for bad. It's a question of just the power. Right? There's nothing in the world that's intrinsically good or bad. Just depends how you use it. Money, use this way or that way. Right? Good looks, you can use it. Do it for tremendous good in the world, you can wreak havoc. So this power depends where you tune it in. So you could either tune it in to a false target, a bodhisattva. You could try and relate to the kedusha, the spirituality, the transcendence in something in the universe that's not the source. That's the opposite of what you should do, and get a high that way. Or you could use it to tune into the source, the kedusha, what's that called? Nevuah, where it speaks to you, that's prophecy. So when you kill that organ, you lose both functions. When you take that organ out of the neshama, when you take that out, so no longer will people want to worship Avodah Zarah anymore, but they want a kedusha anymore. Because the same part of the neshama that could hear a higher voice, that could hear a higher voice in a tree or in the sun, and perceive its kedusha and its spirituality, its ruchniyus, so that's the same sensitive part of the neshama that can hear prophecy. It's clear. So when they operated on the neshama, that fine scalpel they didn't have. You can't do that. They had to cut it out. They had to cut out everything good about it, everything bad about it. So they cut out that organ. That's what the Gemara says. And we were left after that time with no drive to idolatry and no drive to kedusha. We don't hear prophecy. We don't hear prophecy anymore. We're not interested in it anymore. We're interested in the body. We're not interested in that anymore. It's a very weak voice now. Very weak voice. Now. What was left is a place. Now this is very, very, very subtle, very, very difficult object. What was left in the place of that organ? What was left in the machine? What was left in the human soul? What replaced that desire? What was left? That core of the human. They didn't just take away a peripheral part, a little finger. They took away the core, the place where the tefillin are, just below where the tefillin are in the spiritual structure. The place that wants to transcend, where a baby's head is open, it says. Where the skull is open, the fontanelle, where it's almost connected, out. Not again, not to be able to see anything. They took away the part of the human that connects with the higher. But as a truth, what was left in its place? Emptiness. Emptiness. And so the desire for expression out, above, and connecting above became a desire for nothing. Because there was nothing there anymore. And what was once a pleasure of transcendence in a generation where nobody would have wasted time, nobody, when there was a base of Mikdash around and the beam around, where the world glowed with spirituality, where the world was incandescent with spirituality, incandescent, luminous with spirituality, nobody sat around talking nonsense. People did much worse things. People sat around doing negativity. But that's not the same punishment as speaking nonsense. The punishment for doing bad in the world, you used the power you generated there, but you didn't waste it. There wasn't that concept in the human of waste. Nobody would have been able to understand in those generations sitting around doing nothing. That definitely was perceived as death. But after that generation, when they took out that organ, the drive was replaced by what we have. A drive for nonsense. A drive for nonsense. The place where we should relate to transcendence, we have an enormous pleasure in nonsense. That's the difference. You'll see that, if you think about it in many ways, you'll see that the tradition is also, and this is the last thing, in a few minutes we won't go through, you see that if you really want to understand the pleasure, if you want to analyze deeply the pleasure of speaking nonsense, you'll see that the pleasure is what's called the pleasure of Patur. Patur means being exempt. It means being outside of obligation. It's escape. It's escape. And the Foshim say that it's the same pleasure when you sit and talk nonsense and you forget everything else. Talking nonsense, that activity, generates the same pleasure in the neshama as the moment of going on holiday. When a child gets out of school, or the weekend, or you close the office, or you go on holiday, not when you're on holiday, then you're bored already. Once you've got used to it already, it's not any. The experience of breaking the bond, right, of the two, as you break the bond, as you step out of the shackles, it's a tremendous breath of fresh air of power. Even though what you step into is nothing productive. Right? Even though what you step into is not engaging your power to build, you've thrown off the harness of what builds in the world. But there's a tremendous pleasure in it. The kedusha of it is an experience. The kedusha of it, the holiness of this force, is what a person experiences in the next world. The next world is a place where you don't have any shackles. The happiness of the next world is a place. The happiness of entering that place is what's called patur. That's why we talk about death in Hebrew, we call it nifta. Nifta means he's patur now. Why do we call nifta? What does nifta mean? Nifta in Hebrew. That means patur, means he has no more obligations. He's patur now, he's free. Free of his obligations. That's what it means. The happiness of being free of obligation, of course, that's only happy if you fulfill the obligation. Like we said before, if you pull that harness all the time, so that when you're free of it, you leave behind a job well done. So that's a happiness. But it's a big agony for some.